Weekdays, 10 Talk. Entertaining and informative radio for the Sunshine State.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
You may be owed some money. After 911 and 411, call 541. That's 727-541-1741. Call Gulfstream Motorsports for a diminished value report. Due to my 28 years experience in the auto salvage business, I'm very good with wrecks. So if your car's been involved in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for the lost value of your repaired vehicle. And visit us at GulfstreamMotorsports.com.
It's another bailout with no legislation. The hill's going to go crazy. The country's going to go crazy.
The plane that we flew in on this morning leased from AIG. Construction downtown, AIG. Life insurance, 81 million policies with a face value of $1.9 trillion. Billions of dollars in teachers' pensions. It's everywhere you want. Too big to fail. Here it is. Got a better idea, though. Suggestion box is wide open.
We are of the view that the United States needs to take strong, decisive action to arrest the stress in our financial system. Through our new TARP authority, Treasury will purchase preferred stock in each of the banks represented in this room. That stock will yield 5% the first 5 years, 9% after that. We give you money, you lend it out. It will unfreeze credit, stabilize the banks, restore confidence. Everyone will be better off with more capital in the system, and that is why all nine of you will participate in the program.
Some of us don't need any capital.
You all need capital. You have no idea what the market's going to look like in a year.
Neither do you. I'm not one of you New York guys with your fancy products. Well, why am I in this room talking about bailing you out?
The stronger banks will serve as cover for the weaker banks. If just some of you take it, the money is a signal that a bank is too weak to survive. The market will devour it.
How much are we talking about?
$125 billion. Bank of America, $15 billion. Bank of New York Mellon, $3 billion. Citigroup, $25 billion. Goldman Sachs, $10 billion. J.P. Morgan, $25 billion. Merrill Lynch, $10 billion. Morgan Stanley, $10 billion. State Street, $2 billion. Wells Fargo, $25 billion.
What happened to buying toxic assets? Wasn't that the idea?
It's too slow. He'll be dead before we sort it out.
So we're just handing the reins over to you?
Deal's actually pretty good. You turn your nose up at this now and we have to rescue you later, the terms won't be nearly as attractive.
It's cheap capital. It's not the worst idea in the world.
Well, just for those of us who already have capital.
We will be non-voting shareholders. This will be a temporary measure.
What if we decline to be involved?
The chairman of the FDIC is sitting right there. Tomorrow you'll find out you're not as well capitalized as you think you are.
Hi, I'm Bob Lutz, former vice chairman of General Motors, and I like listening to nostalgic radio and cars and Semper Fi.
Okay, listeners, welcome. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and I'm your show host, Robert. Run your computers and Google TamTalk1340.com, and you can see us live here in the studios in downtown Clearwater. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com, where you can find out all about us. And if you've missed any of our past shows, don't forget to check out NostalgicRadioandCars.com. Well, I just got back from Colorado, so big shout-out to my friends at Fastlane Travel, where I was working as an assistant tour guide, and to my new friends that I met, Bill and Bill, Larry and Larry, Sonia and Angela, Jackie, Rob, and Dexter. And Dexter lives in Florida. Rob lives in Florida. Jackie lives in Florida, so that was kind of cool. Some of the people were from Oregon, some of the people from Ohio, some of the people were from Pennsylvania, and believe it or not, Albuquerque, New Mexico. And of course, Peter, our intrepid Treffenmeister and Spaßmacher, and the founding CEO of Fastlane Travel. We had a spectacular time. Definitely check out our website, fastlanetravel.com. And you need to join us on some of our tours. They're a lot of fun. A lot of them go to the United States and drive all over the place. And some go to Europe and drive all over the place. But all the details are on our website, fastlanetravel.com. All right, we got an exciting show for you tonight. I'm going to keep it a surprise. The clip was a clue, and we're going to play some Elvis for you. You're tuning into Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back.
Follow that dream. I've got to follow that dream.
Keep moving. Move along. Keep
moving. I've got to follow that dream wherever that dream may lead. I got to follow that dream to find the love I need. When your heart gets restless, time to move along. When your heart gets weary, time to sing a song. But when a dream is calling you, there's just one thing that you can do. You've got to follow that dream wherever that dream may lead. You got to follow that dream to find the love you need. Keep on moving. I move along, keep on moving. Gotta find me someone whose heart is free. Someone to look for my dream with me. And when I find her, I may find out that's what my dreams are all about. I've gotta follow that dream wherever that dream may lead. I gotta follow that dream to find the love I need. I gotta follow that dream wherever that dream may lead. I gotta follow that dream to find the love I need. Keep moving, move along. Keep moving, move along.
Okay, guys, we're back, and you're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and it's time to introduce our very special guest for the evening. This lady has an impressive background. She is a former investment banker. She was also an assistant secretary to HUD, which is House and Urban Development for Housing. She's a well-known speaker, an author, and the founder of the Solari Report. And I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening Catherine Austin Fitz. How are you this evening, Catherine?
And you've got to tell them I'm a complete car lover.
Oh, you are a car lover. That ties in perfectly with Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
So it's really funny because, you know, I live in the Netherlands and the U.S., but in Tennessee. So I'm outside of Memphis, and we, of course, have the Elvis Car Museum. And I'll never forget the first time I saw the pink Cadillac he gave to his mom. It was one of my favorite cars. And it was one of the first cars I ever fell in love with when I was a child growing up, because we had a rock and roll star who came back in one of those pink Cadillacs. And I remember standing in front of that pink Cadillac and thinking, you know, I'm violating the Ten Commandments because I'm worshiping a car.
Interesting.
Anyway.
We had Deborah Allen on our show. She's a well-known singer, Nashville. And her dad, when she was a child, did some of the paint and bodywork on Elvis Presley's limousines. And
really?
Yeah. And this is in the early to mid 50s when he was an up and coming star. And what was interesting is the fact that they would go over to his house and he was Uncle Elvis. He was just a cool guy.
Exactly. So there are thousands and thousands of people and stories. So where I live, if you say a negative thing about Elvis, you could get yourself in real trouble. But Elvis Presley was the best neighbor who ever lived. If you look at how many people he helped, you know, somebody get in trouble, he'd just write him a check. He would go out of his way. I had a cousin who was in a car accident, and the first car to come up behind was Elvis and his retinue, and they stayed there, and they helped get the, you know, the car went off and got the ambulance, and they stayed there. Elvis stayed there with him until the ambulance came, and the next day he came to the hospital to make sure they were okay and prepared to pay the bill just in case they didn't have, you know, the ability to do it, which they did. So he didn't, but he did that for, I'm telling you, it's the best neighbor who ever lived.
Wow. It's sad that he's gone, but you know, his legacy is incredible. And his music, we play it a lot on our song. In fact, we'll probably play one of his songs on the show tonight, just because you like him, and we always try to accommodate. So we'll do that shortly.
No, I don't like him. I love him.
Okay. All right. That's even better. So let's talk a little bit about your background. So when you were an investment banker on Wall Street, and you worked with, was it Dylan Reed? And of course, they got bought out by somebody, And of course, there's all this M&A, you know, mergers and acquisitions and consolidation and stuff. So what was it like when you were on Wall Street back in the day?
So I loved it. I loved it because I grew up on the streets of West Philadelphia. And, you know, they call Wall Street the street, but it's like that because it's so fast moving and wild. And I just loved it. I worked at Goldman Sachs for the summer between years of business school, and then I went to Dylan Reed. And I just had a fantastic career. I loved every minute of it. And, you know, there are just hundreds of stories, but it changed during that period. There was more and more dirty money flowing in, and so the corruption was getting worse and worse. And it really changed between when I started in 78 and then when I left to go into the Bush administration. And it was one of the reasons I went. I'll tell you the story. There's a very famous deal called the Federated Campo deal. And Dylan Reed, First Boston was the lead in the takeover of, I think it was Campo was taking over the Federated department stores. And the guys in the leverage buyout group wanted to come in behind First Boston, take a big position. And all the partners would go to the board meeting on Monday morning. And so we all went. And one of them made the presentation. And he showed, and it was clearly over-leveraged. It was clearly too much junk paper and, you know, you're overpaying. And the thing didn't make business sense. But anyway, so the sources and uses of fund had $150 million that was going to come from productivity improvements that the middle managers were going to eke out over the next 15 years. I mean, this is how the game is played. You lever the thing up and then you squeeze it. And in the uses of funds, there was $220 million of fees for investment bankers and for the big lawyers and the top executives. And I looked at this and I said to the partner in charge, I said, Steve, this will never work. These people, you know, this will be in the proxy. The middle managers don't have to sit around for 15 more years and work their butt off to, you know, to make us rich out front. They can walk with their feet. This deal is going to fold. And he, you know, everybody looked at me like, we knew we shouldn't have made a girl a partner. And he said to me, look, we'll be out by the year end. I said, but our bond buyers won't be. And I literally walked downstairs and said to one of the guys who works for me, how'd you like to go to Washington? This market's going to crash. And I'd like to be part of the cleanup team. And that's exactly what happened. And that deal absolutely folded. And if it hadn't been for the bond, you know, the guys who run the bond desk getting us out early, it could have tanked the whole firm. So, you know, it was it was pretty wild, but it got by 89 when I left, the dirty money had really taken over.
So you're talking in Wall Street in general, so or big business
In the world. So
in the world, okay.
So if you look at the corruption world dealing with either, you know, at the county level, at the state level, at the federal level, whether it's election fraud or you know, different issues around control files like the Epstein files or you know, I focus a lot on the missing money because I like to look at issues that impact all of us. And if you look at how much money has disappeared from the federal government, you know, it's $65,000 per person, not counting the financial crisis. If you count that, it's another $80,000 per person. So, you know, you add that together and that's why everybody's feeling so much inflation.
So if you, as the rule of thumb was, you know, from an investment side, you either had real estate or you were in stocks and bonds. And they always said there's a 7 to 10 year cycle. Now, would it be fair to say, and then when you look back into the, let's just say that when I kind of was cognizant of a lot of this stuff was, or cognizant is not the right word, but when I was kind of, you know, kind of educated a little bit in this, in these, in markets, the stock market moved just a little bit here and there. And then it wasn't until the dot-com era, the 90s, when things started jumping up. You could almost throw a dart at Wall Street at any stock on the NASDAQ or and the Dow Jones. And it would go up and it would shoot up 20 points down to, and there were, you know, 50, 100, 200 times earnings, future earnings. And so you kind of in your mind go, well, wait a minute, is this real? Is this artificial? Is this, so at that point, I was totally tainted, because back in the old days, the stock market might have gone up, you know, a few points here, a few points there, you know, and it was, seemed fairly stable. And everything just changed. And then I'll throw in also, since you were in, with HUD, remember the Barney Frank, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac debacle? Is there a big tie in here?
So here's the thing. We're kind of adding different factors together. One of the things that happened was in the mid-90s, we started with the creation of the World Trade Organization, a new round of globalization. And so you get both an integration of markets globally, but you get a lot more capital pouring in. And, you know, then you get these cycles, including pumps and dumps, where, for example, it was engineered to put a lot of money into tech with the tech bubble, or, you know, more recently, the SPAC bubble or crypto. So you get these sort of pump and dumps within this. But what you are watching with globalization is a much greater securitization of assets into the stock market or into a financial asset. So, for example, real estate, you know, most people, including institutional investors, used to buy real estate. You know, they buy the property, or they have a pool of a manager who was just buying properties directly. They wouldn't buy a publicly traded stock. And you see much more real estate around the world securitized. So we went through a period of securitization, but also a very liberal money, you know, monetary policy, which is basically driving assets up long term. So whether it's inflation, whether it's globalization, whether it's securitization, all these things are creating the kind of patterns that you're describing.
I guess probably the perennial question is, who's behind this? You know, globalization, is it a good thing? Or is it better for the United States to be the United States, Europe, you know, Germany, Austria, France, Switzerland, England, to be their own as opposed to consolidated as the EU, and vice versa? Is that trend going to continue all over the world? So, you know, you throw those elements in there. What's happening?
So a decision was made, and I would say it was, you know, from what I saw, it was made by the people who essentially led the financial system. The decision was made, adopt the Uruguay round of GATT, which Congress did in 1994, create the World Trade Organization, and institute significant globalization. And that shifted capital out of the Western world and into Asia. And if you want to understand it, there's a wonderful description given by Sir James Goldsmith to Charlie Rose. If you come to Soleri.com, you can do a search for Sir James Goldsmith. And he came to the United States and tried to persuade Congress not to pass the GATT approval. And he describes exactly what it's going to do to America and the middle class. And it's interesting because I was in Washington and I had a company, and we were trying to persuade the federal government to re-engineer how they invested in at a county level so that we could build significant new wealth and integrate new technology in a way that would make money for the average family and help small business. And that was resoundingly rejected. And I wrote a book about that called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. They clearly wanted to centralize economic and political control and use criminal means to do it, as well as globalization. And I describe it all in Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. You can pick it up on a search, and it's published on the internet. So, you know, this was clearly very intentional. And part of it is that new technology allows us to do all sorts of new things. But if used in this way and applied in this way, you can dramatically centralize economic and political power. And that's what we've been watching ever since. And that's what I think most people are struggling with today. That's part of what's creating the inflation we're all experiencing. And it's basically being used to wipe out the middle class. I mean, you're literally watching a war on small business. I mean, inflation is bad enough, but if you look at regulation, taxes, you know, all sorts of things, there's a real war on small business in most areas, in most industries, in most sectors, and a real push to consolidate market share into the big businesses. So during the pandemic, the publicly traded companies were allowed to stay open while all the small business and mainstream were shut down. And that moved tremendous market share into the big box and online companies.
So it's almost this is the part that's the questions. Okay, so I also want to point out, too, that you are the founder of the Solari Report. So real quickly, why don't you tell everybody what the Solari Report is?
Right. So what happened during to me was I tried to stop the corruption in Washington, including the corruption in the mortgage market, which was the corruption in the mortgage market, which led to the financial crisis. So I was trying to warn people about money being stolen from the U.S. government, as well as the mortgage bubble and how that was stealing from people. And I ended up in litigation with the Department of Justice for 11 years. And very, you know, I'd always worked for big government and big corporations. I'd never worked for individuals. But during that period, to win, I had to go public. People like me never, you know, I'll never forget the first time I had to do a radio show. It's like I could barely speak. I was like, what? You know, I can't talk to millions of people about money. You know, I only talked about money at the jockey club and on the syndicate desks. Anyway, it was kind of a switch. But I had lots and lots of people ask me if I would help them as an investment advisor. And I did. And then I got the same 50 questions every week. And I said, well, we're going to have to convert this to a podcast. So I added a podcast initially just for my clients. But then we started taking subscriptions. And if you come to our site, the tagline is live a free and inspired life. And we have a building wealth curriculum in this. The first is your free and inspired life. The second is navigation tools. And what we say is there's an official reality and then there's reality. And the official reality is for the cocktail party. Reality is for the management of your time and money. You don't want to get those two confused. You need to know both. And our job is to help you do that with, you know, as little time as possible, but also help you do it in a way that you stay in a state of amusement. Because it's pretty easy these days when you look at the news to get overly depressed. So anyway, so what we try and do with the Solari Report is help you do that, to try and understand what's really happening, really, but then what the official, how it compares to the official reality, and how you can use that knowledge to help you navigate. We also, if you look at the building wealth curriculum, the third pillar is risk management. Because, you know, when you're in the middle of a war zone, which is what this is, we call it omni-war, David Hughes's expression for the weaponization of everything. When you're in a war zone, it's more important to not lose money than to, you know, seek opportunity. So we focus a lot on risk management. And there's a lot, you know, in a world that's changing this dynamically, there's a lot you can do to protect yourself against risk. And then we have two pillars, living equity and financial equity. Living equity is all the things you can't buy and trade and sell. So it's education, it's culture, health. But, you know, all financial equity, in fact, comes from living equity. So it's very important. Then, of course, there's financial equity and all the things that go in there. And the last pillar is called Turtle Forest. And it's about never quitting, because if you never quit, you can master all the other pillars. But if you do quit, and it's, you know, people get depressed in this environment and they give up, and you never want to do that. You never want to lose your love, and you never want to give up.
So my question is, part of this actually started what? With the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. So the goal is basically control. But what I don't understand is, how do they benefit by eliminating the middle class, when the middle class is basically the largest consumer of retail products as a whole? So what's
you don't need them anymore. You don't need them anymore. You've got robots, AI, automation, and you just don't need them anymore. And you think that you will reduce environmental pressure by reducing middle class. Remember, once you globalize, you know, you take a whole world of people who are living at $1,000 to $3,000 per year per capita. And you bring them up to where we are. If they come up to 65,000, you know, per capita per year, that's unbelievable environmental stress on the planet. So anyway, so you just feel like there are too many people. It's too hard to manage them. And you just don't need the middle class at all, because you can institute through digital technology complete control. If I put you on a stable coin with a social credit system, you know, it's even worse than a CBDC. I can basically turn your money off. I can tell you, look, you can't travel more than 5 miles from your home, because your money won't work more than 5 miles from your home. I can say, well, you shouldn't be eating pizza, so your money won't work to buy pizza. I could say, well, you know, we don't want to have cows anymore, so we'll have lab-grown meat. You can only eat, you know, or I say, okay, I'm mandating this healthcare treatment to you, and if you don't take one every month, I'm going to turn off your money. They think with technology, they can get complete control, and they don't need you to be in, they don't need you. They just don't need the middle class anymore.
Well, okay, so now we're going back to the Middle Ages, almost what this sounds like. So what happens?
No, I would say it's a high tech. It is medieval in certain respects, but it's very high tech. We're talking about extremely invasive technology where they think they can control your mind and control your body with digital technology and telecommunications.
Well, that brings us to the Genius Act that just passed. Now, I don't know a lot about that. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Right. So the Genius Act is an act which is designed to create sort of the framework for a stable coin market. So we have a stable coin market now, but it's relatively small relative to the potential. A stable coin is a coin that's collateralized by an asset so that its value remains stable, or that's the goal. And a stable coin can be collateralized by a dollar or gold or other things, but the Genius Act is focused on stable coins that will be collateralized by the dollar. And the idea is to create a cryptocurrency, and when that cryptocurrency is purchased, that stable coin, the money must be held in treasury bills or high quality bank deposits so that the dollar, let's say I buy a stable coin for a dollar, that dollar is sitting in the bank in the form of a treasury bill or bank deposit. And so it represents an actual dollar. And the idea is to use stable coins through the mobile payment systems to encourage people all over the world, 6.5 billion plus people all over the world who don't use dollars, to get off of their local currencies and into dollars, thus doing two things: reinvigorating the market share of the dollar as reserve currency globally, as well as providing a new source of funding to treasury bills, because the federal government is running and continues to run massive deficits. The question is who's going to buy more treasury bills? And this is a way of getting everybody on a local currency around the world off their local currency and into stable coins, dollar stable coins, in a way that will provide lots of new money for the treasury market.
All right. So by comparison, tell us about Bitcoin. So if stablecoin is actually backed by an asset, Bitcoin is not. It seems like a Ponzi scheme. Is that a precursor to this to get people conditioned to accept digital currency? And where do we go from here?
Well, so Bitcoin, the total crypto market right now is about $4 trillion. Bitcoin's about 2.5. So it's by far and away the largest Bitcoin. It was created as a payment system. And if you look at the design, it could have been a payment system. It literally got hijacked and turned into what I would describe as a pump and dump Ponzi scheme. So I agree with you, it's a Ponzi scheme. The question is, are the people managing it going to keep it levitating or just pump it, and then when they're through with it, dump it? And there's much debate around that. And I don't think if it's people running the market necessarily know, but I would describe it. I agree with you. It's a, you know, to me, it's a Ponzi scheme. There's no there. And the only way you keep Bitcoin up is if you can bring in new people. And the problem you've got is you've got a lot of large holders who can't get out. If they try and get out, they're gonna completely tank the market. If you go to Solari, we have a big report called Bitcoin Bailout and a wonderful interview with Steve Patterson called Hijacking Bitcoin. He and Roger Ver just wrote an excellent book called Hijacking Bitcoin that describes exactly how it turned from what could have been a very good payment mechanism used globally into a pump and dump tool. So unfortunately, and Bitcoin is different. People are trying to use it in a variety of different, what I would describe as highly corrupt ways, but who knows what happens. I think the big effort right now institutionally is the US government and the current administration want to use stable coins to flood the world. One, to rejuvenate the dollar as a reserve currency. But then I think the other thing they'd like to do is pump out a huge amount of credit globally. Anybody who's not a dollar debt trap will be encouraged to get in one.
Okay. So if you look at, and I'm not 100% sure, but you know, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, you know, they all have now their cryptocurrency guys that are messing around, and allegedly they have interest in Bitcoin, let's just say. By comparison, Jamie Dimon with J.P. Morgan, and most notably Warren Buffett, says it's a joke, along with a whole bunch of conservative Wall Streeters, with the cryptocurrency thing. I look back in the 90s. Remember when they came out with debit cards? Okay, so debit. Mm-hmm. And then I look back. Now, this is really kind of weird, but there's a connection there. Remember when you used to watch movies like sci-fi movies like Star Trek and stuff like that? Everything was credits and debits. You know, nobody had any cash. Everybody was consistent all the way around. And it's kind of like you're thinking, well, wait a minute. Maybe somewhere some sci-fi fanatic guy that's, you know, there's only a handful of people that supposedly control the whole world, you know, which is something another topic for another day. But all this is kind of like leading up to us. But what you have to do is, since people are sheeple, the ones that can't think for themselves, and so they create this debit system, you know, the debit card. You know, those of us that had credit back in the day, you have a credit card, you paid your minimum, or if you paid, you know, you zero balanced every month, depending on which credit card you had, whether it was AX or whether it was, let's just say, MasterCard. So we get the credit, we got the debit and credit thing going. Okay, so now people are conditioned debits and credits. And a little bit of money management, just a little bit, not much, you know, because people are still financially irresponsible. And then now we have the cryptocurrency thing. And supposedly, like you said, it was supposed to be this really, really good thing. But somehow they got in there, just like you said, and they hijacked it. And now our government's involved with it. And this is all part of this whole total globalization thing. So then the next question is, how does that affect the debt? And we're not going to get into the $21 trillion just yet, okay, that disappeared, since we're $37 trillion plus in the hole. Is there a way that with this stable coin, and then, of course, the other question about the value of the gold in Fort Knox and the value of gold and what it was assessed at way back when versus today's value at $3,400 an ounce? Is there a connection here that what's going to happen with this $37, $38 trillion debt? And does this stable currency come into play here? Because if the dollar's worth nothing and they try to offset the value of the debt with the current value of gold versus what it was when it was assessed back in the 70s, and now we get in this enormous inflation, where are we headed? It's a bit concerning.
Where we're headed is inflation. What we're talking about is the financial engineering that helps keep inflation going. You know, it's the creation of lots more money. Now, in this case, trying to suck it up from other countries as opposed to our own. You know, I don't see a way we do this without it being inflationary unless you have enormous offsets. So, for example, during the pandemic, we had enormous inflation. You injected $5 trillion directly into the economy. We shut down Main Street, and that created a lot of deflation, right? And it also made it cheaper for the people who got the $5 trillion that got injected to buy up the assets from the people who got shut down. So it depends on, you know, it depends on all the other cross-cutting things they do. So I see it as being very inflationary, but there's much that could be done to offset it with deflation. So one, I think it's very likely you're looking at higher inflation of household expenses. You're also looking at the same time, a whole series of events that we can describe sort of under the rubric of automation is going to be squeezing jobs, because the economy is changing. And if you're somebody who's got a lot of expertise in the way that it's changing, then you're in good shape. If you're an electrician or a welder, you're in good shape. If you're somebody who wants to be in the civil service in Washington, you're in bad shape, right? So it depends on how you're aligned up. The other thing is, the stable coin and crypto world is a world that is basically, you're inside a digital concentration camp. You are easily surveilled, you're easily controlled. And so there's a lot of pressure to shut down small businesses that are not, you know, not completely on digital platforms and digital technology or on stable coins or crypto, and get them into the distributed ledger space, because they're much easier surveilled and controlled there. You know, and this is part of trying to get, again, to a much more centrally controlled economy. Now, if you look at whether you call it stable coin with a social credit system and a real ID or a CBDC, it's basically the same thing, although stable coin is probably more dangerous because it's more controlled by private people. But then you're talking about implementing a financial transaction control, which in essence is going to put the bankers in charge of everything. So the bankers in the U.S. have always run monetary policy, or at least since 1914 when the Fed went operational, but this is going to put the bankers in charge of fiscal policy too. So ultimately, you're looking to do everything through the financial system and basically put the legislators and executive branch out of business, or put them under complete control.
So we're headed towards one world government and complete control by the elitist and the banksters. It's not looking too good there, and one world currency. All right, so then the question is, what happens to, I'm just going to talk from a layperson, okay, assuming I'm just the average guy. So what happens to companies like Ford, General Motors, companies that manufacture appliances, Coca-Cola, food companies, companies that mass produce general consumer goods? They depend on capitalism, the free market, the middle class consumer, and utilitarian products that we use on a day-to-day basis. If their goal is to wipe out the middle class, and as opposed to having a wide variety of consumer products, for example, you're just going to have some basic little Banzai Toto special that we're going to drive around with. We're all going to have the same thing, and nobody's going to have, let's just say, a Porsche or Mercedes or a BMW or something like that, or a fast Mustang. And then we're all wearing the same clothes or uniforms, if you will, and we live in structures, identical cubes. On top of that, we wouldn't be educated. We'd be ill-informed, brainwashed, kept stupid. They would be taking away all incentives to be productive and to excel. We would be basically slaves to the elite and the government.
So this could go many different ways. So, for example, the economics could change so that the price of energy, because of technology, drops so low, the price of sort of technology and software drops so low that at some point, it's easier for everybody to learn how to make their own car. So you certainly don't need a lot of car companies. You know, you need a lot less capacity than you have now.
But if you wipe out the middle class and then nobody can afford anything other than the run of the mill, in other words, it's kind of like they're standardizing everything. Here's just like you said, I can't go more than 5 miles. Boom. I can't eat a pizza if I want to. Boom. I have to, you know, I have to eat processed food. Boom. And if we're going to that, that's just like a total controlled society. I would think that the people with common sense, myself included, would probably try to revolt, but then we won't have anything to fight with. It's kind of like a...
So far, I mean, I think many people would push back.
Okay.
But I think many people don't, you know, it's hard to fathom, if you've grown up in relative liberty, to fathom that anybody would want to do this.
Yes, exactly. That's my point.
Right. And so here's the thing, and this is why the Epstein story is important.
Okay.
You have to understand we're talking about people who have a value system, which I would describe as demonic.
So now you're getting into the Massey Johnson Trump squabble thing. Is that where we're going with this?
Right.
Okay,
right.
Go ahead.
So we're talking about pure evil here. We're talking about people who implement genocide, who kill on scale, mm-hmm. and they're dangerous. And there's a wonderful, I don't know, did you ever watch the Yellowstone series?
No.
On Kevin Costner? There are these two brothers in the Yellowstone.
Yellowstone. Yes.
Yeah, Yellowstone. Okay, so do you remember in the second season, the Beck brothers? The question is, you have these two guys who are just dirty players. You know, they just use dirty tricks. They kill, they maim, they poison your herd. They, you know, they're always winning because they dirty trick everybody. And so finally, the hero and his sons get together and they're like, what are we going to do about the Beck brothers? And they finally realize they're going to have to kill the Beck brothers. So at the end of the second season, one of the sons, who's a retired special forces guy, corners one of them on the toilet in the bathroom. And he doesn't want to have to kill the guy because he doesn't like killing. And he says to the guy, why do you make us do this? What, you know, why are you putting me in a position where I have to kill you? And the Beck brother says, because nobody ever fights back. And the kid says, we do, and then shoots him dead on the toilet. And, you know, but the whole big sort of theme of the second season is, what are we going to do about the Beck brothers? And that's America's problem. What are we going to do about the Beck brothers? Because my entire life, you know, that was the question when I was a kid in West Philadelphia. And it's the same question. The crime that pays is crime that stays, and they get worse and worse and worse and worse. And now what we're watching is we're basically watching the country melt down because they're having to face the fact that Washington is full of pedophiles and people who are protecting them. And they're trying to compute how that could possibly be that bad.
That's kind of scary, really. But it's not just pedophiles. It's drugs. It's all kinds of bad stuff.
Yeah. Well, because America is financially dependent on organized crime. So I told you to go watch my video, The Red Button Problem. But America has grown up and built its global power on organized crime, whether it's drugs or trafficking or everything else. And we as an economy are financially dependent on it. And we can't change that until we face it. I used to have a pastor and say, if we can face it, God can fix it. And that's true. But we have to face the fact that we have a financial dependency on very ugly businesses. And if we're going to change, we have to, you know, we have to re-engineer how our money works so that we make money from things that help people succeed instead of making money from things that poison and kill them.
You touched on the red button, which I did see the video. Please share that with us.
Oh, Lord.
Well, a short version of it. Go ahead.
Okay. So I was giving a speech in 2000 to a wonderful group of people who were having a conference on how to evolve our society spiritually. I've been asked to talk about the dependency of Washington and Wall Street on organized crime flows. So I was in the middle of my speech and I was describing congressional testimony on the so-called Dark Alliance allegations, whereby U.S. intelligence agencies were accused of laundering, bringing narcotics into essentially Arkansas and through South Central L.A. Anyway, so a reporter I was working for had been told by the Department of Justice during the testimony that the U.S. economy launders $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of all dirty money. So I said to this wonderful audience of spiritually evolved people, what would happen if we stop? And we had a little conversation. They said, well, you know, that money would go to Singapore and Zurich and Hong Kong. So our IRAs and 401ks would go down in value and our taxes might go up because we'd have trouble financing the government deficit or our government checks might stop. And I said, okay, let's pretend there's a big red button up here on the lectern. And if you push that button, you can stop all hard narcotics trafficking in your town, your county, your state tomorrow, thus offending the people who control $500 billion to $1 trillion a year and the accumulated capital thereon. Who here will push the button? And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, only one would push the button. So I said to the other 99, why would you not push the button? They said, we don't want our government checks to stop. We don't want our taxes to go up. And we don't want our IRAs and 401ks to go down in value. So I said, okay, so you want to continue to have narcotics trafficking going on in your town, your county, your state tomorrow to keep your money flowing. And what I discovered that day, I didn't think the problem was that they wouldn't push the red button. I think the problem was they wouldn't talk about, okay, what's going on and how do we re-engineer it? How do we make money pushing the red button? I call it turning the red button green. How do we make money pushing the red button? Because then we can push it, because nobody ever got rich by liquidating their children, by poisoning their children. And in fact, if you look, the chronic epidemic of illness in the United States is directly related to the fact that you have huge numbers of businesses that make money from poisoning our children.
That brings up RFK's quest to refine foods, do away with bad stuff that goes into foods, you know, some of the ingredients and the synthetic stuff that goes in there, including the poisons, plastics, and chemicals. Now, you worked with RFK, Robert Kennedy, for a little bit there. Tell us a little bit about your experience with RFK.
So very briefly, I've only worked with him briefly, but essentially, we have a chronic epidemic among Americans, but American children. And I would describe it as an extinction level event. You know, it won't be extinction because we're using immigration to replace the Americans who are going extinct.
Bad idea. It dilutes the American culture and our way of life.
When you look at the numbers, it's a very ugly picture. When we started to steal the money, when the money started to get moved out of the federal government in 98, life expectancy started to go down right after the budget deal busted. In 95, in fact, just right after that, the next month is when FDA approved the OxyContin, and the pill mills and the predatory lending really started together targeting those neighborhoods, and the life expectancy began to steadily fall, and the U.S. life expectancy diverged from the other 19 industrial countries, and ours fell and fell and fell until the pandemic, and then it really fell off the cliff. So the divergence between our life expectancy and the other industrial nations is shocking when you look at it. So there is this problem, and you see it in the federal budget, because we now have an HHS budget, which is almost double, because of Medicare and Medicaid, almost double the military budget. And Dr. Mark Skidmore, a year ago, did an analysis that showed if we could go back to 2010 levels of disability, we would save $500 billion on the Medicare, Medicaid, you know, an HHS budget. So this is, it's not only bankrupting families. Healthcare is past education, and I think housing is the number one family expense. But we're bankrupting families, we're bankrupting communities, is this really going to hit the pension funds hard? And we're bankrupting the country because we are not healthy. So what is happening is you see a real effort by some people, including Kennedy, to talk about what's causing it. The problem is, if you look at what's going on, Kennedy's clearly not allowed to talk about the things that are really poisoning us. So we can talk about Fruit Loops, but we can't talk about what the COVID shot did to kill millions of Americans or disable, I should say, kill or disable millions of Americans. So we still can't even have an honest conversation about it. And it's very shocking. When you look at his confirmation hearings, if you're in Washington and you disagree with somebody, you say, look, I disagree with your analysis and I disagree with your policy proposals. Here's my analysis and here's my policy proposals. They didn't do that. They didn't say, you know, I have a better way of addressing the chronic epidemic among American children. They just started screaming at him. And what you realize is they are so deeply vested in the poisoning of American children that they weren't prepared to have an adult conversation. It was very, very scary.
Well, so I always say follow the money, which is cliche, but it's true. And we have a few minutes left. And what I wanted to point out real quick is we definitely have to have you back on the show again so we can continue some of these topics and see how they evolve here in the next couple of months. I've always said this to try to be, I think party affiliations, I mean, the government, they can't be trusted. Nobody trusts them, as well as the media as a rule. And if it weren't for independent programs like ours, for example, that kind of get around and try to keep it real and honest, because we're not influenced by big money or lobbyists or corporate America and free thinkers like yourself and the stuff that you do and the fact that you're out there on the lecture circuit as well. But the average person doesn't, it's like they don't seem to pay much attention. They're just wrapped up in their own little worlds. It's like they don't care. They're like sheeple. Whatever happens, happens. Not for the greater good. It's like one of the things I learned a long time ago when I worked on a couple of political campaigns back in the 70s was look how the candidate votes. Check his voting record. And I know you have supported both Republicans and Democrats and independents. So my thinking was a long time ago, I said, why do we even have parties? Why don't we just have individuals? Because as soon as you say Republicans, as soon as you say Democrat, as soon as you say independents, now suddenly you have to kind of hang with the crowd, so to speak. It becomes clicky. And no, this is our position. No, that's our position. But there's a lot of people on either parties that have good intentions for the most part. Why not just pick the best person for the job and let's just do away with parties? I mean, I don't even know if that's even conceivable. I don't know if anybody's ever suggested that before, but it seems like common sense to me, and I'm a common sense kind of guy. Your thoughts?
So if you look at the polls, we're already there. Dennis Kucinich was running as an independent in the 8th District in Ohio this last round, and he did a survey of the 25 or under registered voters and discovered 4% registered as Democrats, 4% registered as Republicans, and 92% registered as independent or other. So I think we're already there, and it's why you hear people talking about starting new parties. I do think that there is a disconnect between what people keep trying to find some kind of shortcut or savior. In other words, we want a politician to tell us what we want to hear and make it simple and promise us a solution, but we're not willing to really change. In other words, I want to make money from organized crime. I want my free check, but I'm not willing to go to the hard work of getting financially not dependent on the organized crime. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I just want the politician to deliver me the story of why I'm good. We're going to Iraq to save women from, you know, medieval practices, as opposed to switch the oil revenues to get deposited in the New York Fed, right? So we've used politics to avoid the real problems. And, you know, and it's not just the politicians doing it, it's us too. So I think there are real solutions, but they require me changing. I need to stop making money from things that poison or harm other people. I need to start making money from things that add fundamental productivity to the economy and are not corrupt. I need to stop banking with banks that, you know, cause financial crises. If I go through my expense statement, if I go through my revenues, if I go through my balance sheet and I just clean up my own act, if everybody in America did that, there would be a revolution. I mean, if you just pulled your money, if you moved your money out of the dishonest banks and the banks that did the financial crisis to the banks that are good banks or honest banks, there would be a revolution.
The problem is how does the average guy find out about it? You know, because they don't really take the time to do the research.
Oh, come on. No.
No?
During the financial crisis, it was totally obvious. everybody knows, and it's really easy to find out, who runs the New York Fed, okay? New York Fed is the bank account for the U.S. government. The U.S. government was missing $21 trillion and then took its books dark. You know, it takes you 5 seconds to figure out who those are, and their names were plastered all over the media for months and months and months as they got billions, if not trillions, of dollars of bailout during the financial crisis. So don't tell me you can't figure out who they are.
Share some names.
Go to the New York Fed. They are owned by their members. Or just do a search for the top 20 banks in the United States. You know, but here's the thing. Every community in this country, with rare exception, has a really fine community bank or credit union that's run by, you know, a guy who could be played by Jimmy Stewart, you know, in It's a Wonderful Life, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're in every community, and they don't trade derivatives, and they don't, you know, get bailouts, and they do a great job supporting the community, and they show up at the county fair, and, you know, go find them. Go get yourself a really great bank with people who deserve your support, and stop banking with, you know, the guys who couldn't care less if you live or die.
Well, like you said, it's going to require a grassroots effort, and it's going to have to start on a community level and then work its way up to the top.
Right, but it starts with culture. It starts with me saying, I'm going to come clean. If you come to Solaire, we have an article called Coming Clean, and it's about, I'll tell you how that started. I was, in 1998, I was writing a check on JPMorgan Chase personal wealth division, and my hand froze, and I said, why am I banking at the bank that's doing all this mortgage fraud? Why am I doing that? I said, I've got to come clean, and it took me 3 years to get all my company and personal bank accounts moved to good banks. And I kept looking for better and better banks. If you come to Solaire, we have a great series, 4 parts on how to find a great bank, because everybody deserves a great bank. I have an absolutely fantastic bank. I love my bank. You know, I totally trust my bank. They trust me. If there's a problem, I pick up the phone. I get a decision maker. You know, we deal with it, whatever. And everybody deserves a great bank. And you can have one if you're willing to take the time to understand you want to bank with honest people and not criminals. But if you bank with criminals, don't be shocked at what happens.
On that note, Catherine, I want to thank you for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and I look forward to having you on again in the future. If you want, go ahead and give out the information on the Solari Report and how people can find out more about you, and name a couple books.
Yeah, we'd love to have you at Solari.com. You'll find us again, Solari.com. It's the Solari Report, and we have lots of information for free, and then we have a subscription service. We'd love to have you as a subscriber. We do a money and market show every week. We also have Ask Catherine. If you're a subscriber, you get to ask questions. You get your question answered. And then we have a weekly interview, and quarterly we do fabulous wrap-ups, which we publish also in hard copy, that do a deep dive that really help you understand what is going on, really. Anyway, well, again, thank you for having me on the show. It was a pleasure.
By the way, are you doing any lectures anywhere in the Southeast, Florida, Georgia, Alabama area anytime soon?
So we'll have a meet and greet sometime in November. I'm still working out but if you go to Solari, there's a meet and greet schedule, and there's also a event schedule. And so I will be in Florida, I think, in November.
Super.
And October, I'm doing something, I think, in the Tampa area. I'll be in Lakeland.
Perfect.
In October.
Well, Catherine, I want to thank you very much for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars. We truly enjoyed having you on our show. Very informative, very enlightening conversation and topics that I think are relevant to all us Americans. And on that note, I hope you enjoy the rest of your summer in the Netherlands, or Holland, as some of us refer to it as. And I look forward to attending your conference in Tampa this fall. So again, thank you very much. Keep up the good work and stay safe.
You too.
Hey, I want to thank all my listeners for tuning in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Don't forget to check us out here every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. on the Tantalk Radio Network, where you can tune into conversations with some of the most legendary and fascinating names in motorsports, music, and now that we're branching out into finance and business, that as well. Hey, guys, it's summertime in hot, balmy Florida. So get out there, drive your cars, ride your motorcycles, and enjoy your boats. But most importantly, stay safe, drive carefully, and love your family.